looking at us.
Class will come to order. So, well, welcome everyone to the first conference committee meeting between the House and the Senate. And the first thing we're going to be doing is some introductions, but I will say, Representative Mariani, you're right over here. I think we're going to be spoiled a little bit with this committee in that I think we have a very easy task because we have three excellent proposals to work off: the governor's, the Senate's, and the House. And, you know, all of those proposals move the state forward. And so I think we're going to have a very easy task of that. So welcome, Senator. And I think what we'll do is start with introductions. And so I'm Representative Paul Marquardt. And we'll just go around and then get staff, and then we'll come back to the Senate side.
Good morning, Representative Carlos Mariani.
Representative Kathy Brainerd.
Representative Will Morgan.
Representative Dean Erdahl.
Tim Strom from House Research.
Melissa Johnson, Fiscal Analysis.
Lisa Larson, House Research.
Shannon Patrick, I'm the Committee Administrator for the Ed Finance Committee, House.
Joe Gould, CLA for Ed Finance in the House.
Jamel Lundy, CLA for Ed Policy in the House.
Doe Shuni, DFL Caucus Research.
Jody Withers, Republican Caucus.
And then I think before we go over to the Senate side, we have the Revisor's Office, Jason Keenley, and Christina Carberry, who is our page. Be working. So thank you so much. Senator Wieger, do you want to introduce or go around on your side?
Sure. And Chair Marquardt, thank you. And I agree, we have many common themes. We look forward to wrapping this up over the next several days. I'm really excited about the prospect of all-day kindergarten available, the initiatives that we share by and large throughout this bill. There's some perfection that we'll do, especially as we get targets, but we're going to have a great package, and I look forward to that.
Thank you very much.
But I'm Chuck Wieger, as you know, and we'll just go around the table and introduce ourselves.
Good morning. I'm Leroy Stumpf, and welcome to everybody.
I'm Senator Alice Johnson.
Senator Kevin Dahl.
Bjorn Arneson, Senate Council of Research and Fiscal Analysis Staff.
I'm Jay Wilms, I'm Senate Fiscal Staff.
Anne Marie Butler, Senate Counsel.
Data Allen, Committee Administrator.
Caitlin Sider, CLA for the E-12 in the Senate.
Very good, and welcome all. And we set some time up for just some quick introductory kind of comments by the chairs here. And as I said earlier, I think our task is going to be very easy because we have some excellent proposals to work off of. And, you know, we have about a $15.7 billion budget, about 40% of the total general fund budget. So it's very, very important we get this right because the state of Minnesota has always depended on its quality of life to be dependent upon a great education system, which we've had. And what's nice about all three proposals that we've had here before us is that they all invest in efforts and strategies that have a proven track record of improving student performance and closing the achievement gap. And as Senator Wieger mentioned, all three plans put dollars into early education scholarships, starting out early so you can prevent an achievement gap from ever happening rather than trying to spend billions of dollars closing it later. All day, every day kindergarten, which I just saw a story today in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Mounds View is looking at doing that, and one of the reasons they're looking at doing that is because of the anticipation of the state funding that. We all fund more dollars on the formula, and we all have accountability and assessment systems that are going to make sure that the dollars that are spent are going to get the results that we want. And one thing that is also very encouraging is that not only is the focus in all the plans on the student and improving student performance and closing the achievement gap, but it is shaking up and challenging the status quo. It's, you know, not business as normal. And we've got a great state. We've got a great education system. You look at all those things, but we do have some cracks in the armor. we have a huge achievement gap that needs to be dealt with. We are now moving in about the middle of the pack on graduation rates that we need to deal with. And so those who have kind of clung to some of the things we've done over time, that being assessment or other things, need to look at the results, the need to see that we need changes. And kind of one final thing is that I think is important is that when we have so much at stake here with our education system, it's important that we send a very clear and concise message, not only to every student in this state, every resident in this state, but every state in this nation, every nation in this world, that we are striving for the world's best workforce. We are going to produce the best education system we can. And that's why goals should be very high, 100%. Make sure every single student graduates. We've got every single student reading by third grade. Every single student is career and college ready. We completely close the achievement gap. That is going to be crucial, because if we have that in a bill and we've got that vision, that not only says that we're never going to give up on a student, but it says to every family in the state and every family looking to move into the state that we're going to put your student first, and that we're never going to give up, and we're going to give that person the best possible education. And what it says to businesses that are in this state and businesses looking to move into this state is that we have a guarantee here, and we have a mission and a goal that we're going to give you the best possible workforce available in this world. And just last week, the North Dakota legislature enacted about $800 million of property tax relief. $800 million of property tax relief in North Dakota. In comparison to Minnesota, that'd be like us doing a $5 billion property tax relief. It's huge. And I think we can agree right here that we're not going to compete with North Dakota or a lot of these states on tax rates. Nor do we want to. We're going to compete with all these states with quality of life. And I'm willing to match our quality of life and our quality of education, our quality of our workforce and our students with any other state in the nation. And that's going to be the key for our state and for our economic development. And so that's why what we're doing here in the next 10 days or less is so significant and so important that we need to get it right. So, I mean, everyone in this room needs to challenge the status quo, because we can improve and we need to improve, and we need to have that vision out there that we're going to be the best. So with that, looking forward to working with you and Senator Wieger.
Well, thank you, Chair Markart, and I agree on the vision, the world's best workforce, and I salute you for continuing to evangelize that message and the global goal of 2027, I believe, for attaining that. And as we get into the discussion further, I think we're going to look at some benchmarks too on how we're measuring how we're doing on that. We have a statewide goal already at 2020, ready for K. We invest to get there, but let's look deeper too into how we get there. For that important milestone for Ready for K, the measurements that we have in the system. I'm so happy with the reforms that we're making jointly on the testing and getting it right for college and career. But with those changes comes the importance of the accountability in the system to make sure we're measuring up to that. And so when we say 100% graduation rate, 100% college career ready, et cetera, those measuring benchmarks or however we decide, I think will be an important part of our discussion as we go about that in the next several days. One part, as we await our targets, we know there's an $800 million difference right now between the bodies and what the governor is working on. But we spent a great deal of time talking about education finance reform. And as you did, and I know the work that was put in on for equity, we addressed that. There's never quite enough money to do it. We've each have taken some good steps there. We also addressed the need for property tax relief, and it was put right in our bill. We bought down some levies, and we added the gen ed levy. Part of the task force, the governor and the commissioner addressing the need for school finance reform, and I know you're all aware of those important initiatives, and we have some of those, and as we get our targets and further review the importance of that, I'm sure we'll come together. So look forward to the great policy initiatives that we've laid out. We're going to make progress, and I'm really excited about it.
Thank you very much. With that, I think we're ready to really get going. I think the first thing we're going to do is go over the spreadsheet. And so who is Ms. Johnson, if you would do that. And so that should be right, the first thing in your packets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As you know, that both the House and the Senate have tracking spreadsheets that track both the appropriations and the levies. And for sake of simplicity in going through the spreadsheet, we thought that it would be helpful to not toggle between the two, but work with just one. So for the appropriations tracking, I'll be talking off of the House's appropriation tracking. So just to give you a brief orientation to the layout of the spreadsheet, the first set of columns is for the House fiscal 14 and 15 in the biennium. And then there's a fourth column that is the difference between the House and the base. And this is where you can easily see where the House changes are relative to the base. And if you follow this column all the way through the spreadsheet, you'll get to the House's bottom line target of $550 million. The next set of numbers is the Senate's proposal, and those are for 14 and 15, and again also has a column for the targets that would follow through to the end. The most important column to keep track of as we're walking through the side-by-side of the House and Senate proposals is the column right in the middle of the page called the difference between the House and the Senate. Here you will be able to easily eyeball where the significant differences are between the House and Senate and see where those negotiation points will be throughout the process. The last set of columns is for fiscal 16 and 17. We aren't budgeting for these, but we are tracking to the extent that changes are made in the current biennium, the 14 and 15 that we're planning for, how those impacts would impact, or how proposed spending changes would impact those out years. So we're keeping track of that. The general order of the spreadsheet ties pretty closely to the organization of the omnibus finance bill. So the first page here is the Article 1, the general education. The next page would cover student accountability, education excellence, and special ed, so the Article 2, and so on. So that's just a general orientation to the spreadsheet. So as we move through the spreadsheet, my House counterpart or my Senate counterpart and I will be speaking to provisions that relate to our body. So if we start on line 5, if you look at lines 5 through 8, you'll see the basic formula amount. The House's position is that they would like to increase the formula allowance 2% in both fiscal 14 and fiscal 15. The current basic formula amount is $5,224, so the House would increase the formula amount by $104 for a total of $5,328. And then for fiscal 15, it would be a $105 increase for $5,433. I'll hand it over to my Senate counterpart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The Senate position is a 1% increase in fiscal year 14, an additional $52. And in fiscal year 15, you'll notice from the spreadsheet that the number rises significantly. That's not related to new money, but that's accounting for the pupil weight changes that take effect in fiscal year 15 as part of the governor's proposal.
Very good.
And then on line 10, just want to touch on briefly the aid payment shift. There's a slight difference in the way the House and the Senate are accounting for appropriation. The House's position is that appropriations are at 86.4%, the current shift percentage. It's not noted here, but the House returns the aid payment percentage to 90% in the tax bill. And it is the decision has been made that any spending or the spending in the target for the House is all paid for at 90%.
And Ms. Johnson, Mr. Welms, don't wait for me to call on you. You're doing just go back and forth
right.
As you
okay.
Do it.
Thank you.
You've got it all planned out here. So this is good.
And the Senate's position is, you'll notice that there's a small reduction or a 1% reduction in the aid payment shift. The February forecast aid payment shift percentage is 86.4%. And due to the Senate's proposal, where there's $150 million in levy reduction, there's a loss in savings on the property tax recognition shift. And so that loss in savings is made up for by adjusting the aid payment shift percentage.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to go through the complete spreadsheet, or if we have questions along the way?
Yeah, I think Senator Stump, if you have questions along the way, why don't we take them now?
Mr. Chairman, just a kind of a general question. I'm wondering. Since we do not have targets that I know of, and since the target is, or since the House and the Senate are rather quite a ways apart, I'm just questioning in my mind the value of a couple of things. The differences between the House and Senate overall is going to have to, you know, obviously at the leadership level is going to have to be settled. Mm-hmm. And then the other big question is, which is very closely tied to that, is the whole area of the buyback of the shift. And I know it's probably beyond this committee's responsibility in terms of knowing exactly what's going to happen, but if we go through the spreadsheets, realizing that, you know, the House's target is quite a bit higher than the Senate's target, I'm not sure the value of doing that.
Well. So, Senator Stump, you're thinking maybe wait to do the spreadsheet until a later time?
I think that would probably be more valuable.
very good. So why don't we do that? So what we'll do is we could come back and look at this part later after the, and we're hoping to get those targets fairly soon. I know they're making progress. So, well, is that fine with members then, Senator Wieger, Chair?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't we then, right now, bypass the spreadsheets and go to the side-by-sides.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Strom.
There's two documents in your packet. There's a side-by-side summary that some of you may wish to work off of, and there's also the side-by-side bill language. Mr. Wilms and I will be going through Article 1. Perhaps the easiest and best way for us to do this in terms of efficiency is I'll start on the House side. Whenever there's a Senate provision that's different, we'll switch over to the Senate side, and Mr. Wilms will go down the printout until we find something different on the House side and switch back. But otherwise, we'll just sort of describe the provisions in order as we're going through, alternating between House and Senate provisions. We'll try not to take too long
Very
on this.
Good staff. I was going to say, if you were to err, you would err on the side of brevity.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much.
So, members, we're going to start with Article 1. Mr. Wilms, summary would be fine, yes. So we can either work off the summary or the language in the bill, whichever is easier for members. You've got both of those documents in front of you. Mr. Chair, members, I'll start with Article 1, Section 1. This is the same in both bills and has to do with the kindergarten adjustment we'll make later in the bill. We've got a slight difference in Section 2. I'll speak to the House side, and Mr. Wilms can comment on the Senate language. Same principle is being approached by both bodies. The concept of hours of instruction is important for purposes of determining extended time revenue and a few other things. With kindergarten going to full-day kindergarten, the hours of instruction that are currently required are 425 for half-day kindergarten. In the House language, you'll see that the House essentially says that if you're going to have all-day, every-day kindergarten, those students have to have a minimum of 850 hours of instruction, and that's, again, primarily for purposes of calculating extended time revenue. The House also adds a second provision there on lines 3.9 and 3.10 of the actual bill language that will be found elsewhere in the Senate bill that requires at least 165 days of instruction for students in grades 1 through 11. Mr. Wilms may want to comment on the slight difference on the Senate side.
For Section 2, the only language change there would be the instruction that the all-day kindergarten school calendar must include 850 hours of instruction.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilms, then we'll move on to Senate 3, Section 3 of the Senate side and explain some of these changes that are now on the Senate side only.
So beginning with Section 3, and this will cover Section 3, 4, and 5. These are all regarding the pupil accounting weight changes. There's resident marginal cost pupil units and adjusted marginal cost pupil units, and these are changed due to the formula simplification that takes place in fiscal year 15. So Sections 3, 4, and 5 are technical changes relating to that.
Section 3 of the House and 6 of the Senate are the same, and these just have to do with an adjustment to the non-public pupil aid to reflect the fact now that kindergarten pupils are counted at full day for many purposes.
And Section 7, again, is another technical change for pupil weights.
The next couple of sections, Mr. Chair, are the same in the House bill and very similar for the second one. The first has to do with transportation. School districts are allowed only to provide the transportation authorized in statute for post-secondary enrollment options pupils. Additional language that's the same is added to both that allows a school district to provide that transportation for pupils in specific programs when there's an agreement between the school district and the post-secondary institution. In terms of the next transportation section, the change let's see here. We have one little difference, and I forget what that is, Mr. Oh, the change is actually on the bill line 6.16. There's an additional cross-reference that the House needs to put in related to a special ed change. This is just a technical change, and otherwise the language for transporting homeless children is the same, but the cross-reference change on line 6.16 is simply dependent on which special education formula we go with. The next section, Section 6 of the House bill, has to do with how a school district may allocate certain contracted expenses. This allows a district to use the actual contracted rate, the actual payment rate, instead of allocating that amount on a cost per hour or cost per mile or cost per route basis. There's no comparable provision in the Senate bill.
And Section 8 is another technical change relating to the calculating for inflation adjustments for non-public pupil aid and non-public pupil aid transportation. And the change here is meant to neutralize the impact of pupil weight changes. And that's Section 8.
Mr. Chair, the next section, Section 7 of the House bill and 9 of the Senate, are the same and are also reflected in the governor's bill. This essentially requires the school board, if it's going to allow a pupil younger than age 5 to enroll in kindergarten, to have an early admissions policy.
Okay. We're on page 4 now of the summary.
Mr. Chair, the next provision is in both bills is the same. Section 9 in the House bill is different from Section 12 in the Senate. Let me briefly explain the changes in Section 9, and the Senate can explain their changes to the career and technical program. Secondary vocational, now called career and technical, is currently a levy program that's 100% forward shifted. We're switching over from a formula that was based on
a variety of things, including number of pupils, to a new formula that's 35% of approved program expenditures. That change was enacted a few years ago and will first be effective for revenue for fiscal 15 for taxes payable in fiscal 15. The House adds some language that clarifies how those expenditures are going to be counted, but that's the only change on the House side.
On the Senate side, for fiscal year 14, there's an additional aid component that's added on. The cap on the levy remains in place, but additional aid is made up. So it changes the career and technical revenue formula to add an aid component. For fiscal year 15, the additional aid money takes the effect is that it reduces property tax. So in fiscal year 15 on the career and technical levy side, you'll see property tax relief from the additional aid. So the demand or the money spent kind of levels off across the years at approximately $24 million.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 10 on the House bill establishes a definition for referendum market value equalizing factor. Later in the bill, you'll see that three formulas that are equalized aid and levies, where the levy is spread on referendum market value, you'll see that these are now essentially indexed to the statewide market value per pupil, and it's this definition that does that. And then as you see those three programs later, you'll see a specific percentage added for the level of equalization. The next change, Mr. Chair, I'll talk about the House version, is the full-day kindergarten. Both the House and Senate have full-day kindergarten funding, slightly different in the mechanism to do so. Under the House proposal, the pupil weight is increased to 1.0, and that amount would be multiplied by the formula allowance, so that every child who's in a full-day, everyday kindergarten program would generate that 1.0 pupil weight. If a child is still in a half-day program, they generate their current weight, which is 0.612 pupil units. This pupil weighting plays through in all of the formulas, starts with the general ed formula, of course, but would work through all of the other formulas. In the House, this is first effective in fiscal year 15, so second year of the biennium.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, what was it seems to me that in the Senate discussion that one of the proposals that was brought to us by the department was to try to simplify the per pupil weighting, and I know on the floor of the Senate we used an argument of simplification. Mm-hmm. To if you take the old weighting system and go through it, nobody, not even the best experts, understand what it means. And so I think our committee felt that it would be nice to simplify it so that, you know, a student, when you talk about a student, you have kind of a clearer idea of what that student's value in terms of state dollars would be.
Yeah, Senator Stump, we had looked at that, and I agree. I think for probably business managers and kind of for insiders, the 1.0 for bookkeeping is simple for the average person out there. I think it's the dollars that matter. They don't really care probably how it gets there. But we found when we did that, there tended to be fluctuation between just depending on the number of elementary students versus the number of secondary students that each school had, we ended up getting ups and downs and some disparities. And so we couldn't work out a real good way to try to keep everything. In our plan, when we did the 2% and the 2% on the formula, we wanted to make sure everyone got 2% and 2% on the formula, versus if you come in and you're doing this, someone may get more, someone may get less. So we thought the best way. But I mean, I think this is we're very, very open to this. That's just if we can kind of maybe solve some of these, level this off, that we saw some disparities between various school districts. That was kind of our concern. But no, it'd be nice just to be able to talk one, mm-hmm. you know, or I mean, it's a simpler concept and probably the way to go. It's just so if we can kind of make sure that we don't have huge ups and downs, that I think it's very workable. Please proceed.
On the Senate side, Section 10, the pupil weights are changed to reflect the changes that were made for all-day kindergarten, so 0.55 for part-time kindergarten and 1 for all-day kindergarten. So the new under the new pupil weights, grades K through 6 would be at 1.0 for pupil weights, and grades 7 through 12 would be at 1.2. And again, that begins in fiscal year 15. Sections 11 and 12 relate to declining enrollment revenue. Some of the changes that occurred earlier, I believe it was Section 7, removes the accounting for marginal cost, and so it strips it out of the pupil unit accounting and establishes a new declining enrollment revenue formula as proposed by the governor.
Mr. Chair, members, the next section is the learning year pupil units. As I mentioned before, this is the definition that essentially is used for calculating extended time revenue. Because kindergarten pupils will now be going, full-day kindergarten pupils under both bills will now be going 850 hours, language is necessary to adjust those amounts so that the students that are receiving targeted services through an extended time program will be counted at the right amounts. So for those still in half-day programs, that would still start after the 425th hour. For those in full-day programs, the extended time funding would start once they've received 850 hours of instruction.
And our Section 13 is, again, technical changes related to pupil weighting.
Mr. Chair, members, the next section defines general education revenue. The House simply eliminates an obsolete reference to training and experience revenue.
Section 14 on the Senate side, in fiscal year 15, alternative compensation is rolled out of general education. The declining enrollment revenue takes effect along with the pupil weighting changes. And then there's a few things that relate to the levy reduction, $150 million in levy reduction. Some different elements get added into the general education formula, including basic supplemental, which is the first $56 of the equity levy, as well as safe schools. And then there's a pension adjustment revenue additionally added into the general education revenue component.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
I had my hand in this one. The reason why the we rolled out, I believe the reason why we rolled out the QComp out of the general education is that it really is a grant program, and it's not a general grant that goes out to basically all districts. And that's something that I have felt strongly about for almost, well, right from the very inception of that program. The value of it is $260 per pupil. And if you look across the state, if you had a map of the state and you looked at who participates in that program and who doesn't, it's generally the metropolitan area and you know, a few surrounding parts of the metropolitan area. Very few rural districts have participate in that program. And I think this conference committee ought to be sure to examine if we, as we move into the assessment and evaluation process that's going to supposedly take place very soon, that districts that are not participating in the QComp program virtually have no resources. Rural districts do not have the resources to expend and go through the process of this assessment and evaluation. And this is a program that should be available to all districts if we had the resources. I just think that we need to be cognizant of all districts being able to have the resources. The governor in his proposal had $22. Of course, in small districts where you have just several hundred students, $22 doesn't mean very much, and we don't know exactly what the real cost of that assessment is going to be, but it probably is going to be quite a bit more than the $22.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Senator Stumpf, I do understand where you're going, and I think we probably will have some more detailed discussions around this, but I'm not certain we can resolve this in the confines of the conference committee, that we might need further hearings next session around the whole issue of QComp and what its uses have been for districts, because there is overlap with the evaluation, but it's not necessarily one-to-one. And because they have received that money and built structures within, you know, their own districts around it, I think we might need to take quite a bit of testimony to understand how it does relate to evaluation, and then where other districts who don't have QComp are at in terms of resources they've already brought to bear on evaluation, because many districts already have professional learning communities and are using their staff development resources in that regard. So there's quite a range of approaches districts have taken, and I think we probably need to chart that in some manner, you know, before we understand how we might move forward in terms of the relationship between QComp and teacher evaluation.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, sections 14 and 15 of the House and Senate bill are the formula allowance. As Ms. Johnson said, on the House side, there's a 2% increase each year. So that's an additional $104 over the base of the first year, an added $105 on top of that for the second year on the House side.
On the Senate side, Section 15, again, increases the formula allowance by 1%, and then you'll notice that due to the technical changes from the pupil weighting, the formula allowance rises to $5,687 in fiscal 15.
Very good. This time, before we go on, I'd like to welcome Senator Torres-Ray. If you'd like to just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My apologies for being late, but I do have to transport my kids every morning, so it's very important that I do that when it's raining. They take their bikes these days. So I'm happy to be here. I represent District 63 in Minneapolis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Welcome.
And Section 16 and 17, again, those are technical changes related to the pupil weighting. And then Section 18, you'll see that's where we established the declining enrollment formula as it related to Sections 11 and 12 above. Section 19, that relates to the levy reduction, basic supplemental revenue. As part of the $150 million in levy reduction, one of the levies that is reduced is the equity levy by $56, the first $56, and so it's turned into an aid component, basic supplemental revenue. So that's Section 19. Section 20 on the Senate side is Safe Schools revenue. Additionally, part of the $150 million in levy reduction, Safe Schools for districts was turned into an aid program. The levy authority still remains for intermediate districts, so you'll see from the tracking that there's still some Safe Schools revenue there. An additional $2 was added onto that Safe Schools aid component, and there's also new language setting aside allowing school districts to reserve up to $2 for laminate glass. So Section 22, now compensatory education revenue. These are technical changes for pupil weights. Section 24, again, another technical change. Section 25, another technical change related to pupil weights. Section 26 and 27, this relates, again, to the $150 million in property tax reduction. The operating capital is turned into an aid program. And so you'll see that this relates to fiscal years 13 and 14.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The operating capital levy, the history of that was that it was an all-aid program before 2005. And then when we ran into some budget problems in that part of our history, they basically changed it into a levy program. Right. And so what the Senate decided to do is to take it back to an all-aid program, which was what we do here.
If I remember, Senator Stump, it was equalized at about 22,000. It was a huge equalization number. Then overnight in 1 year, it was lowered to about 10,000 something, which increased the property tax on that by 50%. So, all right.
Mr. Chair, there's an error on the summary that I made on the next section, sections 15 of the House bill and 4 on the Senate. If you look at the bill language, you'll see that I overlooked a not. this is on line 15.14 of the House bill. This has to do with the definition of operating capital and what fees or purchases can be charged to that account. The House picked up the governor's language, which excluded annual licensing fees for software and that kind of thing from operating capital revenue. The Senate can speak to the change they made, but this is on line 15.14 of the House bill, where the House picked up the governor's language and excluded licensing fees from operating capital.
And, okay, yeah. So I think the House accurately stated the Senate's position in that we do make this expanded use eligible for annual licensing fees. Section 28 and 29 are technical changes, again, related to pupil weighting. Section 30 removes the old language, and sections 30 through 32 relates to the new equity revenue formula as the governor proposed.
And, Mr. Chair, on the House side, there's an equity change in Section 16 and not entirely different in revenue from that provision that Senator Scoy is carrying as part of his education advancement revenue in the tax bill. Let me briefly describe the change here. There's four parts to the equity formula. One of those parts right now is an additional amount of equity revenue for districts with a low referendum. That's capped, however, at $100,000 per district. So for larger districts with no or little referendum, there's relatively little adjustment in equity. What the House does here is essentially brings every district with less than $300 of referendum up to that amount through the equity formula. We'll see that when we get back to the spreadsheets, how that's built in there. There's not a levy offset as there is in Senator Scoy's provision, so that's essentially the big difference here. Under Senator Scoy's version of this provision, there's a substantial amount of tax relief, of property tax relief, but the revenue effect of this change and Senator Scoy's is similar.
Very good.
Transition.
Oh, and I'm sorry, Mr. Wilms. Let me add one other thing. On the equity levy on 16.34, this is the first of the three market value levies where the House raises the equalizing factor by linking to a percentage of the referendum market value. The 122% raises the $476,000 to 500 and I don't have that number in front of me, but I think $526,000.
And then that number is indexed into the future. So, you know, a lot of times school districts, they'll pass an operating referendum and they're maybe paying 50% levy, 50% aid, and within 5 years, because that equalization number has stayed the same, they're paying 100% levy. And so this would index as the average land value goes up, things would stay index up accordingly. So hopefully what you entered into, because a lot of times citizens will say, okay, how come all of a sudden my taxes are going up on this portion when you said that the state would cover this amount in aid and now they're covering nothing. So hopefully it will even add a little more understanding and transparency into that process.
Okay. Section 33 relates to the transition revenue, oftentimes called the hold harmless revenue. There's components for safe schools integration due to the expiration of the levy, and then also the TRA reduction that's implemented in the Senate side. By removing that, there's also a hold harmless provision for pension adjustment revenue that's carried in general education.
And Mr. Chair, the transition levy is the next component, sections 18 of the House bill and 34 of the Senate. On the House side, just as with equity, it's a higher level of equalization at the $526,000 level because of the linking to the referendum market value equalizing factor.
Sections 35 through 37 relate to alternative compensation. This is what was mentioned earlier about rolling alternative compensation out of general education. And it strikes, additionally, it strikes obsolete and old language. Section 39.
Page 10?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. Okay. 38 is pension adjustment revenue that relates to the TRA reduction that I mentioned earlier that the Senate eliminates.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Weaker.
Thank you. I just want to point out for the pension adjustment, like pupil units and a couple other items, it's all a part of the governor's recommendation on the task force on school finance reform.
Very good.
And Section 39, again, that is a technical weight change or a technical change related to removing adjusted marginal cost pupil units as well as all-day kindergarten. Section 41, again, that's an all-day kindergarten provision. Basically, it allows them to use money for all-day kindergarten to meet the needs of 3 or 4-year-olds in the district. Sections 42 through 45, that establishes the general education levy, which is approximately $20 million in levy for fiscal year 15, and basically establishes the levy as a uniform rate that is set by the commissioner to raise a set amount of money.
Mr. Chair, members, then we've got a couple of changes to the way that compensatory revenue, which is part of basic skills revenue, may be used. Let me briefly speak to the House change in sections 19 and 20, and then we'll have Mr. Wilms speak to the Senate changes. In section 19 of the House bill, it essentially allows a school district to use its compensatory revenue for programs that are designed to prepare children for entry into school. And essentially what would happen here is that that compensatory revenue could go for a broader use. The way that, and if as you look on the in the new clause that's added, it could be, this is on page 18, lines 9 through 11 of the bill, it could be used for early education programs, parent training programs, school readiness programs, 4-year-old kindergarten programs, or voluntary home visits. And this is essentially funded by the provision in the next section, section 20, where essentially a, in section 20, essentially allowing the district to allocate an additional 5% of its compensatory revenue for those activities. Under current law, 95% of the compensatory revenue has to be spent at the site where the money is generated. This would allow an additional 5% to be spent at the discretion of the school board for those early ed purposes.
Thank you. The House and Senate provisions are very similar. Section 47 provides more guidance, if you will, or instructions on how the revenue must be used. It says that it is cost-effective research-based and includes an evaluation component to measure, record, and publicly report its level of effectiveness. So I think that's the key difference there. Again, it's paid for, as Tim said, and the next section, which through an expanded allocation of basic skills revenue.
Mr. Chair, members, next we move on to referendum revenue. I'm sorry, Mr. Wilson.
No. That's okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 21 of the House is the first couple of changes, and if you don't mind, Mr. Wilms, I'll go through a couple of the whole referendum changes for the House, and then we'll back up and do the same for the Senate as a pack here. Essentially, the House converts the referendum allowance to adjust for the full-day kindergarten weighting change. It keeps referendums on resident pupil counts. It does not switch them to adjusted pupil count. So the net effect of the House changes is after the changes are done in fiscal year 15, every school district would still have the same amount of referendum as it did before. It would continue to be based on resident pupil counts for subsequent years, but their allowance would be slightly modified to reflect the larger pupil count because of kindergartners counting as full-day kindergarten pupils. The second change in the referendum provision in the House bill is in Section 23 of the House proposal, and that's where the equalizing factors are affected. Again, here linked to the statewide referendum market value changes set at 122% for the first tier and 66% of the referendum market value equalizing factor for the second tier.
Thank you. Regarding the referendum changes, I'm going to actually turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Arneson, and he's going to walk through some of the changes that were made to referendum.
Mr. Arneson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the one of the key differences between the House and Senate positions is that referendum revenue in the Senate position is calculated on adjusted pupil units rather than resident pupil units. The Senate bill performs an analogous sort of transformation of the referendum allowance for the pupil weight changes. The effect is that the referendum allowance is converted, assuming kindergarten weights at 0.55 in fiscal year 15. And then subsequently, as a result of adding some weight to kindergartners post-conversion, districts do realize some additional referendum revenue because of that increased weight. In lines 26, beginning at line 26.33, there are some technical changes related to the referendum allowance limit, similar in fashion to what I just described. Again, beginning at 28.4, some technical changes related to pupil weight changes. Beginning at 28.30, referendum equalization levy, largely technical changes related to pupil weighting. There are some non-technical changes in the real value of those equalizing factors. So it's kind of a mix of both equalization policy and pupil weighting technical changes. Beginning at line 29.4, referendum equalization aid again is calculated on adjusted pupil units rather than resident marginal cost pupil units. Beginning at line 29.26, the Senate bill guarantees that a district's referendum equalization aid won't decrease as a result of the basket of changes. That guarantee does impact a few districts and bring their referendum equalization aid up to the level that would have been true under current law. Beginning at 30.7, again, we have technical changes related to the calculation of referendum revenue on adjusted pupil units rather than resident pupil units. And that concludes the Senate's position on referendum revenue.
I think I'll pick up on Section 50, which is compensatory supplemental formula aid. This originally began, or it was, a pilot program in fiscal 13, and it was set to expire, and so the Senate adopted this provision, which is basically sets an additional supplemental aid amount to the top 20 largest districts based on compensatory revenue dollar amount, and basically it's 1,400 times the sum of the district's pupils eligible for free lunch and one half the district's pupils who are eligible for reduced lunch in the prior school year minus the amount of compensatory education revenue. So it's based off of that. Section 52, 51, that relates to the elimination of early graduation scholarships that's carried in the appropriations tracking in the general education area. Section 52, again, these are technical changes, 34.19 through 34.21 related to adjusted pupil units. And then again, later on in that section, you'll see technical changes to that.
Mr. Chair, members, the next section, 24 on the House side and 53 on the Senate side, have to do with the lease purchase levy. Under current law, there's a reference to a cross-reference to districts that are currently eligible for integration revenue under clauses 1, 2, and 3 of section 124D86. Essentially, those were the first-class cities at the time that provision was written. Because the 2011 legislature repealed 124D86, that cross-reference is no longer sufficient. So essentially what's happened here is the House and Senate have both picked up the governor's language, which names the districts, the four first-class city districts, and allows those districts to continue to do certain lease purchase activities. Other districts would only be able to do those activities if they're directly related to a inter-district desegregation effort. Mr. Chair, members, Section 25 is the Safe Schools Levy. As Mr. Wilms mentioned, the Senate increases the Safe Schools Levy by $2 per pupil and rolls that into general education. The House keeps the program entirely as a levy and adds $4 per pupil to the, or $5 per pupil, rather, to the total amount of Safe Schools Levy, and then expands the uses. Those are at the end of that subdivision. Those uses include the laminated glass, which is a part of the Senate provision, other facility enhancements such as public announcement systems, emergency communication devices, and any facility modifications related to violence prevention and facility security. The uses are also expanded to include any costs associated with improving the school climate or to pay with to pay costs associated with mental health services. So those are essentially the changes in the levy language. Those apply to all of that $35, so a school could choose to use any portion of that for any of the existing list or any of the expanded list.
As Tim mentioned, in Section 54, this regards the Safe Schools levy program. Nearly the entirety of it was turned into an aid program, but as I mentioned earlier, the intermediate levy authority was retained, and so that's what Section 54 pertains to.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, members, yep. Section 26 has to do with the calculation of the taconite levy reduction. There are provisions in both the House and Senate tax bill as well related to taconite funds in school districts. What this provision does is essentially reflect that change a calculation as to what portion of the taconite production revenue that's due for school levy reduction goes to schools. A change that was made about 4 years ago changed that allocation method and inadvertently created a loop where every year the school reduction was 95% of the previous year's amount, which meant a smaller and smaller portion of that taconite replacement or levy replacement, that taconite reduction to the levy, was going to the school districts, and a larger amount each year was going to the cities and townships. What this change does is essentially freeze that at that 95%. So that each year the 95% of the reduction goes to the school levies, and the remaining 5% is to the cities and townships. As I mentioned, this provision is in both the House and Senate tax bill as well. Mr. Chair, members, the next change has to do with the alternative attendance programs. This is in Section 27 of the House bill and Section 55 of the Senate bill. Part of the language is simply getting rid of obsolete language for when these changes were first made. But then the second part of this has to do with how special education tuition billbacks are handled. This change is a fairly significant change for open enrollment purposes and charter schools. This starts on line 26.21 of the House bill. Essentially what happens here is only 90% of a school district's special education unfunded special education costs can be billed back to the district of residence. Under current law right now, when a student open enrolls or attends a charter school, the serving district bills back 100% of the unreimbursed costs to the resident district. Beginning in fiscal 15, the House and Senate would change this to 90% of the unreimbursed costs. This is similar to the provision that the governor had as well.
On the Senate's position, Tim noted the similarity there regarding the special education billbacks. One key difference related to this section is alternative attendance. The calculation for that was rolled into the referendum, as my colleague Mr. Arneson had talked before. So you see that eliminated from this section. And then there's also a technical change here related to transportation for charter schools, and that's related to the pupil weight changes taking effect in fiscal 15. Section 56 is a technical change for pupil weights again. Section 57, another technical change regarding the pupil weight accounting.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 28 of the House bill has to do with the enhanced equity aid. That provision in the House starts in fiscal year 14. The levy for that year has already been set. So for that additional up to $300 of equity revenue for the no referendum districts in fiscal year 14 only, the full amount of that is provided in state aid.
And Section 60, that is basically language that gets carried in the omnibus bill, neutralizing the impacts of changes in tax proposals on the proposals under this bill.
Mr. Chair, Sections 29 of the House bill and 61 of the Senate bill are the appropriations sections. As Senator Stumpf has asked, we'll not talk about appropriations differences unless there's a rider as we go through the articles where it may be worth pointing out what that is, as that may be the only place that language appears. Mr. Chair, members, then if we jump ahead to the repealer, the only provision being repealed by the House, this is Section 30 of the House bill, is essentially an obsolete cross-reference or an obsolete subdivision related to the referendum calculations. So that's the only repealer currently in the House bill in Article 1.
In Section 61, the repealer, there was a number of changes, definitions for operating capital, certain provisions related to the equity and transition revenue, which were replaced by new formulas such as basic supplemental, referendum conversion allowance, which is obsolete, alternative teacher compensation, which is rolled into general education as an aid, rolled out of general education, excuse me, and then the TRA reduction is repealed as well.
Mr. Chair, that's Article 1.
Very good. Article 2.
Mr. Chairman, members, Ms. Butler and I will proceed to do Article 2.
Very good.
Its title is Student Accountability. The first section contains definitions. These are largely technical. They were an effort by the department to reorganize, clarify a number of the accountability provisions in Chapter 120B. There are some differences between the House and the Senate. The House modified a number of the definitions to better reflect the assessment proposals that appear elsewhere in Article 2.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate on that section, I think, kept the language as it came from the agency. Yeah. So then, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 2 in Article 2 in the House side also came from the department. It, again, was an effort by the department to further clarify graduation and accountability requirements. Specifically in Subdivision 2, you have clarifications of the graduation requirements. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 3 in the House has technical and conforming changes. One difference is that the House did not conform with the recommendations from the department regarding striking certain subject areas for the social studies standards. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 4 pertains to benchmarks. Again, there are a number of technical and conforming changes. There is a reference to career and college readiness, which is consistent with the assessment changes that appear later in this article. One additional change the House made was to indicate that the cycle for reviewing and revising academic standards and aligning those standards with assessments would be on a 6-year cycle. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 5 is another department provision largely.
However, the House elected not to make some of the changes regarding career and technical education that appeared in the department proposals. This section becomes effective August 1, 2013 in the House.
And the Senate file makes it effective for students entering ninth grade in the 2013-2014 school year and later.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 6 in the House and Section 2 in the
Mr.
Senate.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stump.
A question on what the House did with the change in graduation requirements. I just didn't hear.
Ms. Larson?
In Section, I believe it was in Section 5.
Section 5, the changes in the graduation requirements.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. If you're Senator Stumpf, are you asking about the half credit of economics specifically?
That was a difference between the House and the Senate?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of components to the House provisions. There are some technical and conforming changes which the department proposed. There is also language proposed by the department making one half credit of economics taught in an agriculture education or business department the same or equivalent to satisfy a half credit in social studies. What the House did not do at the recommendation of the department was make career and technical education changes pertaining to the credits. And that, I believe, was at the behest of Mr. Schoenfeld.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, I'm glad you asked that question. And at some point, we may want to ask Mr. Schoenfeld to come and share his thoughts with the committee as time would permit.
Yeah. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 6 in the House and Section 2 in the Senate is the same. It's a proposal pertaining to planning for students' successful transition to post-secondary education and employment. It requires school districts beginning in 2013-2014 to assist all students by no later than grade 9 to explore college and career interests and to develop a transition plan. There is also a paragraph pertaining to the transformation of this section whereby language currently in statute encourages districts to use non-state revenue and in-kind contributions. That language would be stricken or removed from the statute. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 7 in the House has to do with the E-Pass program. It allows students in grade 8 through the 2012-2013 school year who have not demonstrated proficiency on the MCAs, the grad test, or the basic skills test to satisfy high school graduation requirements by taking one of the grad tests, a work key skills assessment, the Compass computer adaptive placement, or an ACT assessment. In this case, the state would be required to pay for the test costs for the public school students who participate in these assessments. This is effective through 2013-2014.
Mr. Chair, members, the Senate section is quite similar to the House section, except for the Senate does not have language referring to the grad assessments as one of the options. And then Section 5 of the Senate file, there's no comparable provision in the House file, but it provides or expands the guidance to school districts regarding gifted and talented student programs.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 8 in the House and in the Senate policy bill are almost the same. I think it's encouraging versus may, but the idea is that school districts and charter schools are encouraged to provide mental health instruction in grades 6 to 12. Section 9 in the House has to do with computer adaptive tests or CATs for students in grades 3 through 7. This would become part of Minnesota's comprehensive assessment system. The language proposes that students enrolled in grade 8 in the 05-06 through 2012-2013 school year that their state graduation requirements would include either the grad tests, work keys assessment, the compass assessment, or the ACT. Students in grade 8 in 2013-14 school year and later would be subject to graduation requirements that are based on a longitudinal systematic approach to education. It would include career planning, assessments, instructional support, and evaluation. There is the language that requires students to demonstrate proficiency on grad tests as a requirement to graduate is stricken. Instead, in order to graduate from high school, the proposal is that students would attain required academic standards and career and college readiness benchmarks as demonstrated on a nationally normed college entrance exam or take an armed services vocational aptitude test. They would take achievement and career and college readiness tests in math, reading, and writing. This is to analyze students' progress and performance level, to identify students' academic strengths, and also diagnose areas where students need additional instruction, intervention, or remediation, and to chart students' progress to determine what their learning and instructional needs, and also encourage best practices that would support academic rigor. In addition, part of this proposal would involve age-appropriate exploration and planning activities and career assessments that would help students identify career interests and aptitudes and develop a transition plan for post-secondary education or employment without need for remediation. There is also provision to allow students with an IEP to take alternative assessments. For those students, high school students not yet ready for college and career, who have not yet satisfied the college and career measures, they would receive targeted instruction and intervention. Districts and schools are directed to encourage students in grade 11 and 12 who are academically ready for college or career to take courses that would give them college credit while they are still in high school. There is a statement that students are not required to receive a specific score or level of proficiency on an assessment as a condition of graduating from high school. There is language being stricken pertaining to students in grade 8 in 05-06 through 09-10 that allows them to receive a diploma without passing the math grad test if certain conditions are met. There is a direction to the Education Commissioner after consulting with the Minsky Chancellor to use an RFP proposal to contract for a series of assessments that are consistent with the descriptions in this subdivision. They must be aligned with state academic standards and include career and college benchmarks. There would be reading, math, and writing assessments for students in grades 8 and 10 and 11 or 12 that are predictive of college and career readiness, are nationally recognized as a college entrance exam, include a college placement diagnostic exam, and contain career exploration elements. The Education Commissioner and the Minsky Chancellor are to collaborate in aligning instruction and assessment for adult basic education students. The purpose of this is to provide such students with diagnostic information, targeted interventions, so that they may seek post-secondary education or employment without need for further remediation. Furthermore, there's a direction to districts and schools to use career exploration elements to help students beginning no later than grade nine explore and plan for post-secondary education or careers. This would be based on the student's interests, aptitudes, and aspirations, and there is a requirement to use timely regional labor information and partnerships as well as other resources. The purpose of this process is to increase students' engagement in and connection to school, improve students' knowledge and skills, and deepen students' understanding of career pathways. the system functions so that students whose growth and academic achievement between grades 8 and 10 who show adequate actions so that students whose growth and academic achievement between grades 8 and 10 who show adequate progress toward college and career readiness are given a college entrance exam in grade 8 or an armed services vocational aptitude test. Such students are encouraged to participate in programs awarding college credit. Those students who are not yet college and career ready are to be given a college placement diagnostic exam. The purpose is to use the results of such of the diagnosis for targeted instruction, intervention, or remediation. Then such students would be given the college entrance exam as part of assessments in grade 12 or the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Test. Students who satisfy these requirements, who attain required state academic standards that include college and career readiness benchmarks, satisfy the college placement diagnostic part of the assessments, and where applicable, complete targeted instruction, are declared to be academically ready for college and career. There is encouragement, again, to have such students take courses awarding college credit. There is a requirement that a study be conducted to determine the alignment between assessments and state academic standards. And when the alignment is determined to exist, there is a direction to the commissioner to seek federal approval to replace Minnesota's MCAs with these assessments and thereby satisfy both federal and state testing requirements. There is language that directs a school, district, or charter school to record students' progress toward college and career readiness on the student's transcript. There is a requirement that in third through seventh grade, computer adaptive test results be available for diagnostic purposes and also be made publicly available. And there is a direction to the commissioner to establish benchmarks for those computer adaptive tests. They must be aligned with state academic standards. The results must be publicly reported. This section is effective for 2013, 2014, and later, except that the transition paragraph applies immediately, and the computer adaptive testing provisions for students in grades 3 through 7 would apply in 2015, 2016, and later.
Mr. Chair, members, just to point out one difference, or big difference between what Ms. Larson said for on the House side and the Senate side. The Senate does not have the option for students to take the nationally recognized Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Test.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 10 in the House has to do with computer adaptive tests in reading and math for students in grades 3 through 7, beginning in the 2015-2016 school year. The commissioner is directed to use fully adaptive tests beginning in that year. The commissioner is required to ensure that performance data and achievement and summary reports are available within 3 school days, that student growth data are available, that both parents and educators are able to use the data to project students' secondary and post-secondary achievement, and also to use the data for diagnostic purposes. This section is effective in 2013-2014, except that the requirement for computer adaptive reading and math tests for students in grades 3 through 7 would apply beginning in the 2015-2016 school year. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 11 in the House and in the Senate Policy Bill, Article 2, Section 6 is the same, and they contain a conforming change. Section 12 in the House does not have a comparable provision in the Senate. It's an effort to improve the graduation outcomes of students who are, by definition, at risk of not graduating and students who are off track to graduate. There is a requirement that the commissioner annually report summary data on both the 4- and 6-year graduation rates of these students and the success that districts, charter schools, and alternative providers have in identifying at-risk and off-track students, in preventing, in using prevention and intervention strategies, and their success in recuperating and recovering or re-enrolling these students. The provision goes on to define who is a student at risk of not graduating and who is a student who is off track to graduate. The data required under this section would be collected beginning in the 2014-2015 school year and reported annually beginning July 1, 2015. This would be consistent with a section that appears later in this article, directing the commissioner to consult with recognized and qualified experts in developing recommendations for implementing this section. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 13 in the House has to do with school performance reports. The House is recommending that two additional sets of data be included in that report. The two sets of data include the percentage of students whose progress and performance levels are meeting college and career readiness benchmarks, and also from a provision that is, in fact, in Article 3, longitudinal data on progress and reducing disparities in students' academic achievement. This is part of the integration and achievement proposal elsewhere in the bill. This would be effective in 2013-2014.
The Senate file only adds one additional data point, and that's about the percentage of students whose progress and performance levels are meeting the career and college readiness of benchmarks.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 14 of the House is similar to the Senate proposal. It directs the Education Commissioner to adopt rules for a standard high school diploma for adults who are not eligible for K-12 services, don't have a high school diploma, but successfully complete an ABE program. This section is effective immediately.
Here we go. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, just to give Ms. Larson a chance to get some oxygen here, I just want to sort of pause and just really tip my hat to Senator Dahl and to Representative Brainard on the work that we just heard before us. This is, in my opinion, the core of the policy effort coming out of both houses this year. I think it's going to lead to a powerful transformation of pushing for, and helping students go forward. And I just want to acknowledge just how much work this took, obviously beginning with the work of the governor's task force, but then the steady work throughout the session of both Senator Dahl and Representative Brainard, who have continued to work this language thoroughly. And I just can't imagine us in a conference committee having to do the in-depth work to get this right. And so I think all of us really should show a deep gratitude to both of these legislators for this work. And my understanding is that they're still working out some of the language. And so I suspect we're going to see some new language as well coming in shortly. But again, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to state that for the record. This has been quite a venture. It's taken quite an effort, and we've got two great colleagues who have been willing to put that kind of energy into this.
Thank you, Representative Mariani and Representative Brainard, Senator Dahl. This is a major portion of this bill. You have any comments at this point that you...
Thank you, Brainard? Mr. Chair. Well, I'm sure we'll have some extensive opportunity to look at the details, but what I would say is myself and Senator Dahl are really the vehicle for a much larger effort that has deep roots, both in our state and nationally, in an effort to move career and college preparation elements into the high school with a greater alignment between secondary and post-secondary. And that effort is owned broadly in our community by both our colleges and universities and our assessment directors and our high school staff. So I feel like I just feel I've had a special opportunity to be sort of a conduit for a great effort throughout our state, and I'm really looking forward to the benefits for our students.
Senator Dahl?
Mr. Chair, and thank you for the compliments, Representative Mariani. And I echo what Representative Brainard said. We're just fortunate to put our name on a bill like this with the working group and on the assessments. I mean, they did the bulk of the work. We just put it in bill form, and of course the staff and the testing experts and the people that I really got to know and the process, they deserve much of the credit, but I appreciate the opportunity to, as I, to work with the Representative Brainerd and her staff, and again, the good folks that really work behind the scenes.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Very good. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 15 in the House has no comparable Senate provision. It proposes to create Minnesota's best workforce. It would require Minnesota to strive to create world's best workforce by 2027. It's proposing to do this by closing the academic achievement gap, achieving 100% high school graduation rate, achieving 100% grade level literacy for third grade students, and having 100% of students attain college and career readiness. There is a direction to school boards to develop a long-term strategic education and budget plan for student achievement so that these districts can work effectively and efficiently toward realizing the goal. Components of a board plan might include innovative and integrative pre-K through grade 12 learning environments, family engagement efforts, professional development opportunities, programmatic opportunities, recruitment and retention of both teachers and administrators with diverse backgrounds. The plan must include formative assessment practices, other instructional best practices that would inform interventions, improve achievement, reduce disparities in students' performance, and also foster students' career and college readiness. It requires a regional center of excellence upon request to assist a school board with its strategic plan for student achievement. A budgeting process is established under this proposal. Beginning in 2014-2015, a school board must hold an annual hearing by March 1 to publicly report its progress in realizing its student achievement goals, to review its plan, revise it where appropriate. It would require the board to provide the public with at least 3 years of longitudinal data demonstrating progress in realizing student achievement goals. There is a requirement that the board provide the public with a 30-day notice of this hearing on a district website, also that a board submit its plan in an electronic format to the commissioner and the regional its regional center of excellence by March 1. Longitudinal data under this section must be based on one or more of a number of measures that would include, and the data has to encompass both all students and specific groups of students. The data would include third grade literacy rates, reduction in the achievement gap among specific groups of students, high school graduation rates, rigorous course completion rates, career and college readiness rates, rates at which high school students acquire post-secondary credits, and rates of awarding language proficiency certificates. There is a transitional process laid out in this section for the 2013-2014 school year only. The next part of this proposal has to do with regional support. It establishes regional centers of excellence to assist the school boards, school districts, charter schools in implementing this section. The centers must collaborate in providing support to local entities throughout the region for which a particular center is responsible. The department is directed to assist the centers with staff, facilities, technical needs, and programmatic support, and to work with the centers to provide a statewide system of regional support. The commissioner and each regional center must collaborate in evaluating district and school success in promoting and disseminating successful strategies to other districts and schools. Where districts do not make adequate progress, the department, after consulting with the affected regional center, may withhold up to 4% of a district's basic general education revenue per fiscal year and transfer that amount to the affected center so that the center may use the funds to help the district realize its student achievement goals. In the case where a district that receives 3 years of assistance still does not make progress, the commissioner, after consulting with the regional center and the district, may require that a school implement a turnaround strategy. This would be effective in fiscal year 2014 and later. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 16 in the House has to do with a proposal for making the transition between our current statewide assessment system and the proposed statewide assessment system described earlier in this article. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 17 in the House is comparable or similar to several provisions in the Senate. It proposes to establish a Career Pathways and Technical Education Advisory Task Force. This task force is to recommend to the legislature how to structurally redesign secondary and post-secondary education to improve outcomes for students and adult learners, align secondary and post-secondary programs with Minnesota's workforce needs, and measure and evaluate the combined efficacy of K-12 and post-secondary programs. There is a list of elements that the task force members are to consider. These include, among others, how to better inform students about career options, ensure a skilled Minnesota workforce, develop and revise an education and work plan for each student, monitor students' progress with targeted interventions and support, remove the need for remedial instruction, increase and accelerate high school students' opportunities to earn post-secondary credits, better align secondary and post-secondary courses and expectations, post-secondary readiness measures and entrance requirements, increase post-secondary completion rates, and provide post-secondary graduates with skills needed for civic engagement. There is the task force membership and directions to operate are also included in this section.
Mr. Chair and members, in addition to the Career Pathways Advisory Task Force, the Senate has a Career and Technical Education Advisory Task Force, which is to make recommendations on improving student outcomes, alignment between secondary and post-secondary education programs, as well as alignment between education programs for students and the Minnesota's workforce needs, and the efficiency and cost effectiveness of the Minnesota's public secondary and post-secondary programs.
Representative Breinert.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to briefly comment on the fact that on the House side, we actually combined two separate bills. So the Career Pathways Advisory Task Force and the Career and Technical Education Advisory Task Force are both included in ours. So just so you understand the history of that, they're that if you look at them, you'll see the common elements.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 18 in the House, and the provision is the same in the Senate policy bill. It pertains to an adult high school diploma advisory task force. It corresponds to an earlier section that is almost the same in both the House and the Senate. It directs the commissioner to appoint a 9-member task force to make programmatic recommendations on programmatic requirements for ABE programs that would lead to a standard adult high school diploma. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 19 in the House has no comparable provision in the Senate. It relates to an earlier section in the House pertaining to data on at-risk and off-track students. Here, there is a direction to the Education Commissioner to consult with experts and stakeholders on improving differentiated graduation rates and establishing alternative routes to a standard diploma for those at-risk and off-track students.
Mr. Chair, members, if you want to go to the Section 21 in the House and Section 7 of the Senate, they're the same. They're the revisor instruction, directing the revisor to make some technical changes related to the changing or the clarifying of benchmarks and academic standards that were in the earlier part of the bill. Then there's a repealer section, House File Section 22, and then from the Senate Policy Bill 978, Section 8, those are the same, and they repeal some obsolete language regarding academic standards. And then paragraph B of the House file, and then section 9 of the Senate file are repealing rules related to the grad assessments.
And that Article 2? Very good.
Mr. Chair,
we've done some heavy lifting already, Senator Wieger. Got through the first two articles.
There's
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like that last article was pretty heavy on the House side.
Senator Stump, yes, there was, did look like a few more provisions there in a few areas, but... Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, good policy tends to be heavy.
All right, speaking of good policy, we're going to move to Education Excellence, Article 3.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, I'll begin because it begins with Senate file language. Sections 1, 2, 3, 4, no, 1, 2, and 3, as well as 5, are related to increasing the compulsory instruction age from 16 to 17. Then Section 4 of the Senate file allows a parent to withdraw a child from their all-day, everyday kindergarten program and put their child in a half-day program or an alternative day program without being considered a truant. Then Section 5 is again another related to the increase in compulsory instruction age. Then what is Section 1 of the policy bill is related to classroom placement and teacher rating, which prohibits a school administrator from placing a student for consecutive school years in the classroom of a teacher who received the lowest evaluation rating. Unless the school doesn't have another teacher at that grade level.
Mr. Chairman, members, in the House, Sections 1, 2, and 3 have to do with the administration of epinephrine through the use of epinephrine auto-injectors in schools.
Then, Mr. Chair, members, going to Section 3 of the Senate file. It's related to school counselors directs counselors to assist students in meeting the requirements for high school graduation, college and career exploration and selection, college affordability planning, and successful transitions into post-secondary education or training.
Mr. Chairman, members, the next three sections are similar but not the same in both houses. They have to do with the teacher's basic skills exam. The House allows the Board of Teaching to issue up to three additional temporary one-year teaching licenses to an otherwise qualified candidate who has not passed the basic skills exam, which is now described as a college-level skills exam. There is a direction to the Board of Teaching to adopt rules requiring teachers who are renewing their teaching license to acquire a more in-depth understanding of mental illness in children and adolescents.
The Senate file allows for non-native English language speakers who directly instruct in that other language or provide world language instruction to pass the basic skills exam or the skills exam and have opportunities for renewal of that temporary license. In addition, I believe the Senate also has direction to the Board of Teaching to establish an appeals process for those non-native English language speakers.
You know, on this item, both I think the House and the Senate had a Mr. Devine from Pillager, who was that the art teacher,
mm-hmm.
who came forward, and just to make sure, do we both take care of his situation in our bills?
I believe, Mr. Chair, members, I believe so. The Senate just goes further to relate to the non-native English language speakers.
Okay,
but
very good. And then the House bill here, we would take care of Mr. Devine. Ms. Larson? We're looking at his. He has had how many years of teaching? But
it was five.
5 years, and he hasn't passed. So
yeah,
would we take care of him?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the way the House language works, it says for a candidate who has not passed, yet passed the basic skills exam, that individual gets three additional one-year temporary teaching licenses, and then if the district wants to hire that individual, the board may issue a subsequent temporary license.
So we're covered. All right, so we've got that situation covered. Very good. Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I just want to be sure in the Senate, is the school board able to allow, as the House provision does, that they continue after they have not passed the test?
Ms. Butler?
Mr. Chair and members, it allows them to continue. They do have to renew the one-year temporary teaching license, so they would have to, and I think there's a limit on how many renewals that you get, but both bodies have the limits on the renewals.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Well, who, under the Senate then, who grants the renewal? Is it the State Board of Teaching or the local school board or where?
Mr. Chair, members, I think both bodies, it's through the Board of Teaching.
But the local school board.
Representative Erdahl. Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Just asking Ms. Larson, what is the role of the local school board in the House, and how does that compare with the Senate?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, the House is dependent upon the district employing the individual with the temporary license to request that the individual continue teaching in that district with a temporary license, and it's on that basis that the Board of Teaching may issue a temporary license.
And then in the Senate, would the school board also have that same role, or is it just Ms. Butler?
Mr. Chair, members, it's the same. It's contingent on the district wanting to continue to employ that teacher, but they have to make an attempt to take the pass the exam again.
Very good, Ms. Butler, Ms. Larson. Thank you. Okay, we will move on.
Mr. Chair, members, going on that same section, the both bodies have also allowing for additional continuing renewal credits requirements to deal with mental health or expand the more in-depth, I guess, understanding of student mental illness and trauma for teachers getting their license renewals.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 5 in the House allows the Board of Teaching, as we just discussed, to issue up to three additional temporary one-year teaching licenses to a qualified teacher who has not passed the college-level basic skills exam. School districts would be allowed to provide remedial assistance to those persons, and they would include, for example, persons for whom English is a second language, persons who have completed their teacher preparation program outside of Minnesota. The Board of Teaching, under the House language, may renew a temporary license if, as we discussed, the school district employing the licensee requests that the licensee continue to teach in that district under the temporary license. This section is effective immediately.
And to add, on the Senate side, they have to also provide evidence of participating in an approved remedial assistance program through the school district or their post-secondary program.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 6 in the House is the third of these three sections on the basic skills exam. This applies to applicants who are licensed in other states. This would allow the Board of Teaching to issue, again, up to three temporary one-year teaching licenses to an otherwise qualified out-of-state applicant who has not passed the basic skills exam. The board would be allowed to renew the license if the district employing that individual requests that the applicant continue to teach in that district. This section is also effective immediately. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 7 in the House and in the Senate policy bill have very similar provisions. This would require K-12 teachers who are licensed to teach deaf and hard of hearing students to complete 30 continuing education clock hours on hearing loss topics in each licensure review cycle. This is effective August 1 of 2013. Section 8 in the House, for which there is no comparable Senate provision, would prohibit a school board from declining to renew a coach's contract based solely on the existence of parent complaints. This section is effective immediately.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 6, 7, and 8 on the Senate file are related to the rolling the basic teacher compensation into general education, or out of general education, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 9 in the House has no comparable Senate provision. It would allow districts to use the 2% of basic revenue set aside for staff development for teacher evaluation purposes, among other purposes. This section is effective July 1 of 2013.
And Section 9 of the Senate file is another section related to increasing the compulsory instruction age from 16 to 17.
Mr. Chairman, Section 10 in the House, and there is a similar provision in the Senate Education Policy Bill, has to do with an online and digital learning advisory council. The only difference between the two proposals has to do with the number of council members. The council is directed to bring digital learning matters to the attention of the commissioner and the legislature, and to make annual policy recommendations. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 11 in the House is the same as a Senate education policy provision. It would allow a consortium of school districts to jointly apply to the commissioner to operate a flexible learning year program. I believe this was a department proposal. Section 12 in the House is the same in the Senate. It has to do with reading and math core. It would establish a Minnesota Math Corps program to give Serve America AmeriCorps members a math instruction model that can be used to provide instructional support to elementary and middle school students and their teachers and help students meet state math standards. There's a requirement for a biennial evaluation. This is effective July 1 of 2013. Section 13 in the House has no Senate comparable provision. It allows the use of appropriate assessment instruments to measure a pupil's emerging academic English. This is effective for revenue for fiscal year 2014 and later. Section 14 in the House has no comparable Senate provision. It would require a district's education program for English learners to include program entrance criteria. The program exit criteria would be equivalent to emerging academic English measures that are on state assessments for English language development.
Section 13 of the Senate file, which is not a comparable House file provision, is making technical changes related to the pupil weight changes.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 15, 16, and 17 in the House are exactly the same as comparable Senate provisions in the Senate Education Policy Bill. They were proposed by the department. They have to do with American Indians community involvement in directions to the commissioner to consult with the Tribal Nations Education Committee, and also a requirement that the commissioner appoint an American Indian Education Director. Section 18 in the House is
Mr. Chair?
Representative, or Senator Wieger.
Thank you. I'd just like to praise Representative Mariani and Senator Torres-Ray for their leadership on this next section on achievement integration for Minnesota. This is a program that went through a great deal of review, as we know. Possibly it was going to expire, and you're going to see the reflection of a great deal of effort. You were the messengers on behalf of many people, but we appreciate those efforts and that we're going to be able to put together some great reform efforts.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, very quickly, and obviously Ms. Larson will walk through it. What we're trying to do, both bodies here, isn't just simply to renew the program, but actually to reform it and to create a different set of expectations that include our continued desire for racial integration and prevention of segregation in our schools, but to find powerful ways to couple that with academic achievement as well, and then to build in a strong accountability system that actually in many ways mirrors the work under some of the language under the World's Best Workforce. So I think what you're seeing is sort of an evolution of the legislature that's saying we're not afraid to reform the way we invest, and at the same time, we're increasingly interested in having strong accountability systems based on student outcomes.
Senator Torres-Ray, any comments
at this
point?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to echo Representative Mariani's words. I think that there is an issue that we're going to be talking about, and we are working with the department and the staff in terms of the measures that the Senate put in place. I think that there is a great desire, of course, in both houses to really put an accountability piece and a measure, but then we had to really figure out what that means in the context of measures that already exist. So there was a significant provision that was added to the Senate language for requiring longitudinal data and also a measure on reading, math, and writing. And so with the department's effort, we're trying to put some more substantive and practical language into this so that we actually know how this ties to the existing measures. And we're still working on that language, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you. And what I really like about this, it continues the constant theme of both of our bills of just focusing like a laser beam on closing the achievement gap. And so, Representative Mariani, Senator Torres-Ray, thank you. Echo Senator Wieger's comments for really putting this and keeping this going, which is going to be vital to closing that achievement gap and getting that education system to be number one. Very good. So let's go over this.
Mr. Chairman, members,
see what we're doing.
Section 18 of the House establishes a program designed to promote diversity, pursue racial and economic integration, and increase student academic achievement and equitable education opportunities in Minnesota public schools. The House defines what an eligible district is. It is a district that must submit a plan to the commissioner under Minnesota rules that govern school desegregation and integration. Eligible school districts are able to use the revenue to pursue racial and economic integration in schools. There is a requirement that the school board of each eligible school district develop and implement a long-term plan using collaborative structures and systems, in-school strategies, inclusive best education practices, and partnerships with higher education institutions and industries. There are a number of examples provided regarding plan components in the language. There is a requirement that the plan specify district and school goals for reducing the disparity in academic achievement among all racial and ethnic categories of students and promote racial and economic integration over time. There is a requirement for eligible districts to implement a cost-effective research-based intervention and also that eligible districts collaborate in creating efficiencies and eliminating duplication of programs and services. The budget process includes one formal hearing by March 1 in the year preceding the current biennium. The board is required to report to the public its progress in realizing the goals it has identified in its plan. The board must provide the public with longitudinal data showing progress in reducing disparity in academic achievement among all racial and ethnic categories of students and in promoting racial and economic integration. At least 30 days before that hearing, the board must post on the district website the longitudinal data it will use to demonstrate its progress. The board or district also must submit its plan to the education commissioner by March 1. The commissioner must review and approve or disapprove the plan by June 1 that same year. There is a list of six measures that districts may use to comply with the requirement for longitudinal data. These include world language proficiency certificates, student growth and progress in reading and math, preparation for post-secondary academic and career opportunities, completion of rigorous coursework, and school safety and student engagement and connection at school. There is an evaluation component in this proposal. The commissioner is required to evaluate the efficacy of district plans in reducing the disparities in academic achievement among racial and ethnic categories of students and report findings to the legislature by February 1 every fourth year beginning February 1 in 2017. This section would become effective in fiscal year 2014 and later.
Mr. Chair, members, on the Senate side, some differences because they are quite similar. The longitudinal data that the school board is supposed to share, on the Senate side, they're required to show the student growth and progress towards proficiency in reading, math, and writing, and then choose from the remaining five in the list that Ms. Larson shared.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 19 in the House and Section 15 in the Senate have to do with achievement and integration revenue, and these sections are not as similar as the previous section. In the House, the House proposal makes school district eligibility contingent on a district having a commissioner-approved biennial achievement and integration plan. There is an achievement and integration revenue formula established. 2% of the revenue is transferred to the Education Department for oversight and accountability activities. There is a reduction of 5% of a district's revenue in the instance where the district does not meet its achievement goals. The amount of that reduction is then reallocated to districts that do meet their achievement goals. The district's achievement and integration aid would be equal to 70% of its revenue. The levy equals the difference between the revenue and its aid. For Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth districts, 100% of the levy certified under this subdivision has to be shifted into the prior calendar year. The proposal establishes $10 per pupil unit as a district's maximum incentive revenue. It allows the revenue only to be used for programs described in this provision. At least 80% of the revenue must be used for innovative and integrated learning environments, school enrollment choices, family engagement activities, and other approved programs that serve students. Up to 20% of the revenue may be used for professional and staff development activities and placement services, and administrative expenditures are limited to no more than 10% of the total amount of revenue.
Mr. Chair, members, on the Senate side, the eligibility, a school district is eligible, similar to the House file, if they have the improvement plan, achievement and improvement plan, or an integration plan, but the Senate gives priority for funding to districts that have methods that have been effective in reducing disparities in student achievement in the districts within their plan. In addition, the Senate file transfers 0.02% of the district's revenue to the Agency for Oversight and Accountability and allows for 20%, or allows the district's revenue to be reduced by 20% if the district's goals are not met after implementing a two-year improvement plan.
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Mr. Wilms.
If I could also add on, the Senate education bill currently does not carry the integration levy, but that's being carried in the tax bill, the reinstatement of that.
Representative Mariani.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to say I'm real pleased to know that both houses are leading the governor on this issue, and I hope that we will continue to lead the executive branch in regards to the importance of reinstating the levy and with the integration program.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 20 in the House does not have a comparable provision in the Education Finance or Policy Bill, but there is a Senate bill, Senate File 783, that does establish a school climate council. The language in the House proposal establishes a multi-leadership council to improve school climate and safety to provide K-12 students and post-secondary students with a safe learning environment. The section outlines the members on the council council duties. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 21, although there is no comparable provision in the Senate Finance or Policy Bill, there is a comparable bill in the Senate, Senate File 783, which also establishes a school climate center. The House language directs the Education Commissioner to establish a school climate center at the department. This center is to help districts and schools provide a safe and supportive learning environment and foster students' academic achievement. It requires the center to work collaboratively with state and local entities to determine how best to use available resources. Center services include policy review, data gathering, assistance to districts and schools that use the student survey results, skills building, planning, and administrative and financial support. The center is directed to make available resources for safe and supportive schools, to function as a central repository for information, to help develop strategies and techniques for involving parents, and to solicit input from social media. The commissioner is directed to provide administrative services and support staff. The center staff is allowed to consult with the school safety center staff at the Department of Public Safety. This section is effective beginning July 1, 2013.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 16 of the Senate file updates the definition for habitual truant to correspond with the increase in the compulsory instruction age. Then Sections 17, 18, 19, and 20 delay the implementation date for the teacher evaluation system for 1 year to the 2015-2016 school year and later. Then, Then the next section is Section 22 in the House file and Section 13 of the Senate's Policy Bill 978, and that is a Teacher Licensure Advisory Task Force. So that's related to the one-year temporary teaching license that was in the earlier section. And they're quite similar. The House or the Senate file refers to applicants and their mastery of on a college level reading, writing, and mathematics skills exam. And then has a requirement for the appeals process if a request for accommodations are denied. And a little bit of difference in the wording for a membership appointment. And then also some additional representatives on the Senate side where they're representatives from the business community as well as a representative from the School Boards Association.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sandra Wieger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was just going to point out, while we didn't have comparable language for school climate center, I believe we each book it at $1 million for the biennium. So we're in.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 23 in the House is another one of those school climate provisions. It requires that in the first year of operation, the School Climate Center focus on five priorities. They are to establish and staff the School Climate Council, develop a model bullying and intimidation prevention policy, provide regional training and assistance, collaborate with others in making baseline data on the school climate available, develop a web-based toolkit, and there is a requirement that data be analyzed consistent with data practices law. Section 24 in the House is similar to a provision in the Senate. This originally was a John Benson proposal for a grant program It was amended, and it now is a direction to the Education Commissioner to recommend to the legislature by February 1, 2014, on how to provide professional support services through a team staffing approach to public school students. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 25 in the House has no comparable Senate provision. It directs the Education Department to adjust the achievement and integration levy for taxes payable in 2014.
So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 21 of the Senate file is success for the future grant applications, which allows a school district to receive the grant if their grant application was postmarked on or before the department's deadline date for applications.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, we jumped over real quickly because it's the same provision, but I think it's important just to note what both the House and the Senate are doing, relative to the Tribal Nations Education Committee and the Indian Education Director. Some of us who have been around here for a while know that this has been a pretty painful and chaotic up and down, swinging back and forth issue in the Department of Education. There was a historic, I think it was historic anyway, meeting last year with the commissioner and the tribal representatives that produced the work before us. And so just as someone who's been around a little while and sort of watched all of us struggle with, you know, how to provide stability to this work with our first people here in the state of Minnesota, I just want to lift this up very quickly and acknowledge, the importance of it, and real pleased that the executive branch took that initiative, brought us the language, and that both houses have embraced it.
Very good. So we're complete with Article 3. I think we're going to take a break at this time. The House, we have a bill up where members need to get over to the House a little bit earlier today. What we're looking at is recessing now. Looks like we've covered 58 pages of the 89. That's 65.2% of the side-by-side. So at that rate, it's about another hour to go on this. And then possibly tonight when we come back, we could probably adopt some side-by-sides and similars. So the plan is to recess now and come back 1 hour after the adjournment in the House. 1 hour after the adjournment in the House. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as was posted on the legislative websites yesterday, the plan for tomorrow's meeting would be to have us address five subjects: all-day K, early learning, testing assessments, integration achievement, and charter schools. We'll take testimony to an extent. We've had hours and hours on each of these through policy and finance already. We're not going to be persuaded not to do all-day K. It's whether there might be some recommendations, and there are some differences in the bills, and so we'll be looking at how we can sharpen that product as we perfect that for final adoption. It's a great opportunity, obviously, too, for the governor's office, the Department of Education, to offer suggestions, as they will need to ultimately sign off on what we're doing. So that would be the plan for those subjects, and we know that a number of you are working on various sections of the bill as well, and so we appreciate those efforts.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, and we are recessed till 1 hour after adjournment of the House. Class will come back to order. I see we've got some tardies. They'll be duly noted. But I think we will continue here, and I think we're on page 59, article number 4, on the side-by-side. Actually, page 58 on the side-by-side, charter school. So Ms. Larson, would you like to start with that?
Mr. Chairman, members, the first section is the charter school section in law 124D10. There are many, many subdivisions in this section, so perhaps the best way to proceed with section one is just to go through the subdivisions. Yes. So, Mr. Chairman, members, subdivisions one and two in section one are the same. Subdivision three, the House has an additional provision that requires that corporations have no members. Subdivision four in the House side makes members of a charter school board of directors eligible to vote in an election of members. It makes board of director committee meetings open to the public. It requires annual training. It includes on the charter school board of directors at least one licensed teacher who is employed as a teacher at the school, one parent of an enrolled student, and one community member. The board may have a majority of teachers, parents, or community members, or have no clear majority. It allows the board to change its governance structure only by a majority vote of the board of directors and a majority vote of the licensed teachers. It precludes an authorizer from making the granting or renewing of a charter school license contingent on a charter school leasing facilities from that authorizer or entering into a contract where the authorizer has a financial interest. Charter schools under this proposal must document the open bidding process they use when contracting with an authorizer, and the authorizer under this proposal must demonstrate that the terms of the bid are competitive and that the same terms are otherwise available. Mr. Chairman, members, Subdivision 4A has to do with conflicts of interest. It exempts teachers employed at a charter school who serve on the board from conflict of interest provisions that relate to teachers' compensation. It prohibits an individual serving on the board if an individual's partner is a full or part owner or principal with a for-profit or nonprofit entity or an independent contractor with whom the charter school contracts. An individual is prohibited from serving as a board member if the immediate member, family member, is a school employee or the individual is someone with whom the school contracts.
Mr. Chair, members, on the Senate side, the Senate only has language for the conflict of interest that clarifies the provisions don't apply to charter board members that are teachers providing instruction at the charter school. Right. Then subdivisions six regarding the charter contract are the same, and they make clarifying and technical corrections. I think to clarify that the changing of the purpose in subdivision one, where there's a primary purpose, it clarifies how that has to be declared in the charter contract. Subdivision 6A is the audit report, which is the same in both bills, and that requires submitting supplemental information with the independent audit. And then next changes are in subdivision 8 regarding the federal, state, and local requirements. The Senate has just one addition to that list, and that is about the charter schools are subject and must comply with the continuing Truitt notification section.
Mr. Chairman, members, in addition to the provision that Ms. Butler just outlined, the House proposes to add two additional provisions that would apply to charter schools. They are the teacher evaluation and peer review process, and also the requirements for creating the world's best workforce. Subdivision 9 pertaining to admission requirements, including the publication of the lottery admissions process and limiting enrollment, kindergarten enrollment to students who are at least 5 years old on September 1, and first grade enrollment to students who are at least 6 years old on September 1,
appear in both the House and the Senate subdivisions. Mr. Chairman, members, subdivision 11 in the House, having to do with employment and other operating matters, the House adds a provision whereby the Board of Directors is directed to decide policy matters, to adopt a policy on nepotism and employment, and personnel evaluation and policy practices.
The Senate file in that subdivision just clarifies that the Board of Directors is also responsible for matters related to administrative decisions. Then the next changes are in subdivision 14, annual public reports. The Senate has changes to that subdivision in both the finance bill and the policy bill. And the policy bill has some additional language that's not comparable to the language in the House file, and that requires authorizers to compile individual portfolio reports and give those to the commissioner, and it talks about they have to summarize some of the academic and financial performance of the schools that they oversee, the status of the charter schools, and then the process for overseeing and evaluating all the charter schools in their portfolio. Then moving on to subdivision 15, review and comment. There's some similarities there. There's removing some obsolete language regarding the authorizer fee factor, and then some clarifying language related to the payment of authorizer fees. Then moving on to subdivision 17, I believe, is the next place where there's changes. Those two are the same. It refers to leased space and clarifies that the leases need to be submitted by a certain date to the commissioner. And everything's exactly the same. So subdivision 17A is the affiliated nonprofit building corporations. They clarify that the authorizer needs to submit the affidavit to the commissioner for approval for an expansion of an existing building.
Right.
17B is a new subdivision that's created for the positive review and comment. They are the same, and just move that into that new subdivision. The next changes are in subdivision 19. Dissemination of information, those two are the same, and removes requirement that the charter school operators disseminate information on how to form a charter school. Then the next changes come in subdivision 23, causes for non-renewal or termination of the charter school contract. Those sections are, subdivisions are different. The Senate file has some language that allows for, that if a charter schools or the authorizer is going to terminate the contract, that they have to, based on the performance for the three consecutive years of that charter school, and that the performance is based against the federal school accountability measures and allows for closure or decision not to terminate that existing contract. And then they have to, if they decide not to terminate, they have to submit to the public the reasons for not terminating that contract with that school.
Mr. Chairman, members, subdivision 23 in the House is different from the Senate provisions, as Ms. Butler indicated. The House strikes existing language on the process for terminating a charter school contract and establishes a changed process for allowing the changing of authorizers when an authorizer and a charter school board of directors mutually agree not to renew a contract.
Then the next change is in the subdivision 23A, which is only in the Senate file, and that allows the school district to lease a building to a charter school that it authorizes.
Mr. Chairman, members, subdivision 25 in the House and in the Senate share some similar provisions, and then there is a different provision. The similar provision strikes a requirement that a charter school submit a copy of its insurance policy or changes to the commissioner. The House, unlike the Senate, establishes the terms and limitations under which a charter school may borrow money in anticipation of receiving state aids.
And then on to the next section. Section 3 and 4 of the Senate file relate to the general education revenue and the transportation revenue that charter schools receive, and that's just to align with the changes in general education revenue and the pupil weighting.
Mr. Chairman, members, the next number of sections pertaining to truancy in one form or another, there are four of them. Both the House and the Senate have the same provisions. And then the next section in the article is the appropriations section. The House has an additional section, not in the Senate. It is a reviser's instruction, and it directs the reviser to undertake technical recodifications of the statutory sections, or I should say, sections, governing charter schools, including Section 1 in this bill, which we in this article, which we just looked at, with all of the subdivisions.
Mr. Chair, members, we need to go back to one section of the Senate file, Section 5, regarding building lease aid, that has some substantive changes that there is not a comparable provision for in the House file. And Section 5 increases the maximum amount of the lease aid per pupil from $1,314, and then it changes the lease aid formula for schools leasing from a related nonprofit organization or a parent company, an affiliated building corporation, school district, or other governmental entity that don't have the that does not have the original debt on the facility, so that public funds from creating a that doesn't have the facility from public funds for creating a profit for the landlord, the lessor. That's Article 4.
Thank you very much. Article 5.
Chairman and members, Article 5, special programs. Beginning with Section 1, includes the interagency coordinating council in the list of councils that continue until federal law no longer requires them. Same as the House provision. Sections 1, 2, 4, and 5 on the Senate side make technical changes and update cross references to reflect changes elsewhere in Articles 1 and 5 related to education aid and general education revenue. These four sections are effective for fiscal year 15 and later. Skipping down to page R2A5, on the Senate side, section 2 from the policy bill updates some definitions related to emergency, and this, I think, is in the basket of larger changes about restrictive procedures scattered throughout this particular article.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 4 in the Senate, which is the same as a Senate provision in the policy bill, is the second of the two sections on restrictive procedures. The House and Senate proposals are very similar, but there are a few differences. The House file, for example, requires that restrictive procedures plan be posted, and there's also a reference to highly qualified paraprofessionals. In addition, teachers and paraprofessionals are included among the stakeholders that the commissioner consults with in developing plans.
Chair, members, skipping ahead to page R985, section 2, on the Senate side, this change strikes some obsolete language and updates cross-references and makes other technical changes related to, changes in special ed calculations, the bill back to resident districts.
Mr. Chairman, members, as a matter of fact, there are a number of sections in both the House and the Senate bill that are very similar. They make conforming changes, technical changes, eliminate obsolete language. In the House, they are sections 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and they are all technical.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, section 11 in the House, for which there is a similar provision in the Senate policy bill, makes technical and conforming changes. There are a number of these. They were proposed by the department. The point is to conform Minnesota statutes with federal law governing IDEA Part C. Section 11 is one of those sections in the House.
And Mr. Chair and members, one substantive difference on the Senate side is that look at lines 63.35 and 64.1 with regard to families who are experiencing homelessness.
Mr. Chairman, members, sections 12 to 15 in the House, for which there are the same provisions in the Senate, make technical and conforming changes, again related to having Minnesota statutes meet federal law governing IDEA Part C. Section 16, which is the same in both bodies, has to do with a mediation procedure. It would require a parent and a district to complete a mediation process within 30 days, and it would make the mediation agreement binding on both parties if the district agrees to enter into the mediation. This agreement would be enforceable in court.
Mr. Chair, members, there are a few changes in the House bill related to the special education formula changes. Essentially, what the House is doing is picking up the governor's recommendations beginning in fiscal year 16. So, as you may remember, the governor went from a cost-based reimbursement formula to a formula that essentially is a census-based formula where there's a series of counts that are used and students are weighted by disability category and other demographic categories. That change will begin in fiscal year 16, and portions of those changes are included in sections 17, 18, 19, and 20. Those changes are intended to reflect the governor's change, but because it's a year later than the governor's change and because the funding level is different, there are some different coefficients assigned to each of those formula characteristics. When we get to the spreadsheet, we'll see that the House has a $30 million increase in special education funding for fiscal year 16 in the tails. Essentially to help make the transition to the new system of funding.
Mr. Chair and members, section 3, page R22A5, is the Senate's position on special education aid and reflective of the increased aid to state total special education aid contained in the Senate bill.
Mr. Chair, members, sections 21 and 22 are also related to the change regarding fiscal year 16 and section 23 as well. So those changes are all combined to help make the transfer to the new census-based formula beginning in 2016. Section 24 is a definitional section that's amended in both bills, but in the House bill, again, the changes are primarily to calculate the proposed new amounts of special education revenue by district.
Mr. Chair, members, and this is one of the four sections that I mentioned at the beginning of this article that is updated for cross-references and other technical changes.
Mr. Chair, Section 25, again, related to the initial excess aid calculation amounts for fiscal years 16 and later.
Mr. Chair and members, again, Section 5 is merely updated for cross-references to other statutory changes in Article 1.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 26 in the House Article 5 establishes a special education caseloads task force. It is a 10-member task force. It is charged with developing recommendations for the appropriate numbers of students with disabilities assigned to a classroom teacher and for cost-effective and efficient strategies and structures for improving student outcomes. The task force is also to identify special education requirements in state statute and rule that exceed federal requirements and analyze the educational benefits and costs of state statutes and rules that exceed federal requirements. There is a report required to the legislature by February 15, 2014. There is a provision to cause the task force to expire. Section 27 in the House, there has a similar Senate provision. The House directs the commissioner to amend special education rules using expedited rulemaking to conform the rules with federal law governing IDEA Part C, but to the extent that is needed to avoid the loss of federal funds. The rulemaking authority would expire on July 1, 2014.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 16, the Senate side, directs the commissioner to collect and report statistics on homeless children receiving Part C services and report those findings to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 28 in the House and Section 6 in the Senate are appropriations sections, and then the following section in the House has a number of repealers. The House and the Senate repeal the same provisions, but the House is repealing additional provisions not repealed in the Senate. Among the provisions being repealed is access to Minnesota's transition system for children with a disability governing initial aid, the exclusion provisions, revenue allocation from cooperative centers and intermediate districts, obsolete language on 1993 base year expenditures, initial aid, total special education aid, school district special education aid, and revenue allocation from cooperative centers and intermediates, and state total special education excess cost aid, and district special education excess cost aid.
Very good. Article 6.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 6, beginning with Section 1 on the Senate side. Section 1 updates equalizing factors for the equalized debt service levy to account for pupil weight changes. Section 2 updates the appropriated funds for debt service equalization aid.
Mr. Chair, on the House side in Section 1, the same appropriation is amended but is changed from a fixed standing appropriation to an open and standing appropriation so that the amounts need not be adjusted each year.
Mr. Chair and members, Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6 on the Senate side are technical changes related to pupil weight changes. Section 58 on the Senate side, beginning at line 41.1, has to do with the Minneapolis School District. It's very similar to the subsequent section, which deals with St. Paul. Both of these sections would allow these districts to issue and sell GO bonds not to exceed a certain amount. On the Senate side, it's for a period of years certain, and I believe on the House side, it's ongoing. Continuing with page R4A6, section 2 on the Senate side directs the Commissioner of Education to convene a school facilities financing work group to study basically school facility needs and provision, and to make recommendations to the legislature. Excuse me. Continuing with section 6, in both bills, some special bonding authority is provided for the Cyrus School District to remediate and demolish, actually, the existing Cyrus School building, and specifies that this indebtedness remains the responsibility of taxpayers within the existing Cyrus School District boundaries. Section 7, disabled access levy authority for Tracy, and Section 8, elevator repair levy for Norman County West School District, both authorize these districts to levy to make certain improvements related to accessibility of their school facilities.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you can anticipate my comment, and I know you couldn't get that elevator repair in for Norman
I know that.
County West, but we're proud to present that. In our
Thank you, Senator Wieger, for bringing that up. The chair on this side just didn't go. So, thank you.
And lastly, appropriations sections in both bills.
All right. Article 7.
Mr. Chair and members, continuing to Article 7, Nutrition, Libraries, and Accounting. Section 1, on the Senate side, corrects a cross-reference to the levy recognition requirements related to integration levy, and removes a chunk of obsolete language. Section 2 on the Senate and Section 1 on the House specify the amount of reimbursement for the school lunch aid formula. The Senate participants in the National School Lunch Program receive 14 cents for each lunch served.
Mr. Chairman, members, and on the House side, the same provision is amended, but the House increases the reimbursement rate for lunches by 1 cent instead of 2.
And Mr. Chair, members, the next section, Section 3, would require that a school participating in the National School Lunch Program must not deny a child lunch or provide that child with an alternative meal if the child qualifies for a reduced price meal. It does require the child's parent or guardian in other cases to provide notice to the school that the family doesn't have sufficient funds. Section 4, the Senate side, corresponding with Section 2 on the House side, updates the payment, simplifies the method of payment for summer food sponsors. Section 5 on the Senate side is the aid payment percentage related to the roughly $150 million of levy reduction in the Senate bill in order to offset the lost savings due to the property tax recognition shift. The aid payment percentage is adjusted downward by 0.9 points. The next group of sections, I think all are technical changes related to regional library basic system support aid. And paging through, you'll notice that in almost every instance where you see the word grant, the word aid was either substituted or added to that. And I think that that reflects the bulk of those changes.
Mr. Chair, members, then, if you'll move to Section 16, the House is a provision related to fund transfers. Essentially, what the House is doing is authorizing the same provision that was in place for fiscal years 12 and 13 for two more years with one change. What the provision does is it allows a district to transfer money from any account or any fund if it doesn't affect the state obligations, state aid obligations, or the local levy. Under the law as it was for the last 2 years, transfers were not allowed from the community service fund or the food service fund. The new language that's added to this that didn't exist for 12 or 13 was that the staff development reserve was essentially suspended for 2 years. That provision is now back in force, and this essentially on lines 150.14 and 15 would prohibit a transfer out of the reserve for staff development as well. Section 17 on the House side deals with the shifts. Essentially what this provision does is require the K-12 bill to pay for all new spending in the bill at the 90% shift level.
Mr. Chair, the next section on the Senate side would exempt Hendricks School District, a district in western Minnesota, from the reciprocity agreement that the state carries with neighboring states. And finally, appropriations and revisers instruction, updating some acronyms and titles related to library services.
All right, thank you. Article 8.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 8, Section 1 of the Senate file and Section 1 of the House file are the same, and it pertains to data for the early learning scholarships.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 2 on the House side relates to the Minnesota Youth Council. It statutorily establishes this this group. Section 3, Mr. Chair, is the Early Learning Scholarships Program. I'm not sure how you'd like to proceed with this, but the House and Senate bills are fairly similar. There's some small differences. Maybe if members like, we could just highlight the differences.
Sure.
There.
If I think that would be good, just okay. Take the differences if we could.
So, Mr. Chair, if Ms. Butler would like to speak to the scholarship amounts in Subdivision 5 in Paragraph B.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, in Paragraph B of Subdivision 5 of the Senate file, we direct the director to maintain a statewide annual average scholarship amount of $6,000 per scholarship recipient, and then also report the actual average statewide scholarship amount to the legislature.
Mr. Chair, members, in Subdivision 6, there's a small difference regarding the way the director may prioritize applications, and this includes adding the language prioritizing on the basis of the needs of the child and that child's family. There's a small date difference as well. There's a March 15th date. I'm sorry, that date is the same in both. I think the rest of the dates are the same in that subdivision.
In paragraph E of the Senate Subdivision 6, the Senate asks the director to report annually to the legislature on a summary of the geographic distribution of the scholarships throughout the state.
Mr. Chair, members, Subdivision 11 is different in the House and Senate bills. This has to do with the collection and use of data. I know there's still some concern on the House side expressed about the level and types of data that can be collected. There's
There's two paragraphs there. There's information both first authorizing the commissioner to collect data and then secondly treating that data as private data.
I think we're on to the next section, which is the state total adult basic education aid, and that is a growth factor. I think we have both files have the same growth factor, but the House file has an effective date of fiscal year 2015, and the Senate file has an effective date of fiscal year 2014. And then, Mr. Chair, members, Section 5 of the House file and Section 2 of the Senate file are related to the current early childhood education scholarships, and just clarifying that the scholarships aren't counted as earned income for the purposes of some various programs. And those are the same. The House file does have an effective date, and that the Senate doesn't carry, and the Senate file has a shortening of one of the programs instead of actually naming it completely. Then Section 6 of the House file and Section 4 of the Senate file are the Early Learning Scholarships designation for fiscal year 2014. With some technical, they're the same, but with some technical differences, I think. And then appropriations. That's it for Article 8.
Very good. Article 9.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 9 is one of the places where it's probably helpful to look at the language of the bill, as the riders are different on the appropriations. At this time, I won't worry about the overall appropriation level, but just the individual riders. Mr. Chair, members, we'll get through the first four riders here, I guess, in the bill order. They're in a little bit different order, and perhaps the Senate could speak to the riders starting in G and forward.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, beginning with G, there's a $1.5 million rider for fiscal year 14 and $263,000 rider for fiscal year 15, and this is for the department to develop model idea paperwork that will be used by local districts, and there's no money budgeted in the TAILS. Any ongoing support or costs will be agreed through the Office of Enterprise Technology and the department. Number H is $250,000 each year for the school finance division for enhanced financial data analysis for school districts and policymakers. I is a $300,000 grant in fiscal year 14 to the Northeast Service Cooperative for a pilot project related to energy conservation programs in Northeast Service Cooperative member districts. $500,000 each year is to assist school districts in implementing an anti-bullying policy. And K, $125,000 each year is appropriated to the Minnesota Humanities Commission, our center, for civics education. L is not a new provision, but an existing $35,000 transfer to the governor's office. M, $750,000 in fiscal year 2014 only, is for department costs associated with teacher development and evaluation. There's also money set aside for pilot grants for teacher development and evaluation, and this money is to oversee those pilot grant programs.
Representative Mariani.
Just a quick curiosity on the riders. Were these requests of the executive branch, the riders?
Who wants that, Mr.?
It depends on which one. Some were a mix of proposals by the governor, and some came up in committee.
And Mr. Strom, do we have...
Mr. Chair, Subdivision 3 is the license by portfolio. It's the same dollar amount, and I think we just need to make sure we're transferring it to the right place here. I think that function's moving from Board of Teaching to the Department of Education, but it's the same effect, that it transfers money out of the special revenue fund for the licensure by portfolio activities. Section 2 is appropriation for the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and Blind in Faribault. Here the House has a rider, the $85,000 oven at the facility. This is on the language on 162.6 for the nearly 100-year-old oven at the at the Faribault Academies.
Mr. Strom, that is right. I just want all members to know that that oven dates back to the Coolidge administration. And we thought, you know, every 80, 90 years, maybe you should get a new oven. So we did put that in there. And we had some very good discussion that day, actually, in committee. But yes, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, just to add some more relevance there, I noted as a Chicago boy that that was roughly around the same era when the Cubs were actually winning World Series.
Ouch. Representative Mariani, that is a long time. That should be enough to garner support for that provision in the bill. All right. Anything else on Article 9?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has a rider they may wish to speak to in Section 3 on the Perfect Center.
On line 105.3, $750,000 each year is appropriated to the Perpich Art Center to develop an arts curriculum.
And, Mr. Chair, Article 10 is the same as the forecast adjustments.
Well, I thank you so much for nonpartisan staff, partisan staff, revisor's office for putting this together. I know this is a lot of work to get to this point. And just to get these packets together, thank you so much. At this time, Senator Wieger had to leave, but he wanted us to move forward. And so, staff, do we have, so we're going to look at some same and similars and possibly adopt those tonight. That would be okay. So if staff could pass that out. Okay, if everyone has what staff has put together and gone through and looked at some same and similar that does not involve any financing, nothing in Article 4 under the charter schools, so that kind of got to be taken all at once, I think. So we have these. If members would like to, I thought we could take these an article at a time, if that would be all right. And I will entertain any motion. And Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move from Article 1, if we're going to go the whole article at a time. Is that what you said?
Yes. And if you could actually list the section.
Sure. That would be good. I would like to move the Senate language from Section 1 of Article 1, the Senate language from Section 9
A
of Article 1, the Senate language from Section 10 of Article 1,
Hold it just one second. Section 10.
That's what it says on my sheet.
Right.
There, Mr.
Am I reading this? Okay. On page 4, that section 10, pupil unit weights, that must be another article or a different article in the Senate portion. Okay. So I'm trying to find that. I'm on the side by side.
Bottom right corner, page 4.
Side by side?
On the side by side, but that's section 10. That's pupil unit weight.
I believe I heard Ms. Larson say, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On page R11, on the Senate side.
What's R11?
It's on the side by sides. Okay, it's actually, wait a minute, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to back up a little bit here. I'm going to ask for
I'm going to have
help.
Okay. So, Representative Morgan, you've moved Senate Section Article 1, Section 1, Senate Article 1, Section 9.
That is right.
And then Article 1, Section 10. I see that, the commissioner designation. Very good. All right. Please continue.
Okay. And then the designation for this one, I might need a little help from House Research on this, but it's in the Senate language 978-3, section 4.
Mr. Chair, members, there's two Senate files run together here, so when you see that S-978, that's a reference to Senate file 978, and that'll be section 4. That will be across from House file section 15 on the summary and in the bill document.
Okay. Very good.
Yes, yeah.
So that's section 4 from Senate file 978, the third engrossment.
Okay.
And then section 53 from the Senate file. And again, House Research is perhaps going to have to help me find where that is in the side-by-sides right now.
And that's next to, that's the building.
What page?
Yeah, that would be page 13 on the side-by-side right on the very bottom. All right, Representative Morgan moves Article 1 and those five sections. Do I hear any discussion on that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. And these are not amendments being adopted. What's the proper...
Mr. Chair, I think that's just fine. You're essentially building the report that you'll sign from the ground up, so just moving to have them adopted is sufficient.
So the motion does prevail, the
motion.
Articles?
I think the motion prevails, and they're considered adopted in the article that they're
very
in.
Very good. All right. I'm a rookie. Very good. Okay, so those five parts of Article 1 have been agreed to. We've got another area here on Article 2.
I'll move the Article 2 sections.
Okay, this is on student accountability. So Representative Mariani moves on Article 2, House Section 8. I'll make sure we get there. House Section 8, which is on page 19. Of the side-by-side. And then Senate 978-3, Section 7, which would be right across from House Section 21. Let's get that in the... And that looks like revisor's instructions.
Correct. And Mr. Chair, the difference is really pretty minor. The House uses the word the verb encourage. The Senate uses may. It's not a significant difference here.
All right, Representative Mariani has made that motion on Article 2 to adopt House Section 8 and Senate 978-3 Section 7. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. That is adopted. Article 3 is next, and there you should have an amendment. With you, that should be the A169-1. This can we make this all one motion with all five with that being amended then? Okay, so would anyone like to make the motion and then we'll talk about the amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A169-1 amendment.
Okay, I think what we'll do is if you could move all five of those sections.
Article 3 section.
And then the one is amended. And then we'll talk about the amendment.
Okay, so do you want me to list the article,
yes,
the sections,
please,
of Article 3?
Yes.
So Senate 978-3, Section 1 is amended. House Section 11, Senate 978-3, Section 9, Senate 978-3, Section 10, and Senate 978-3, Section 11.
Very good. And the amendment on that first one, S-978-3, Section 1, cleans up and slightly revises the direction of the council regarding what it should consider and provide input on to the department and to the legislature. So just cleans that up a little bit. So has everyone found that in Article 3? Any discussion on the Brinert motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
And my understanding is that the council is developed this language, is okay with the language, and the department is fine with the language as well.
Okay, anything? All right, so we have that motion. I'm going, any further debate?
Chair, I'm wondering if on the 169-1 amendment, if at line 1.4 that should read page 71, delete lines 1 to 12.
All right, let's take a look. 1.4, should that say page 71, delete 1, 2, 12?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Dahl moves to add that, if we can here, to on 1.4, change 70 to 70, page 71. And we'll, it just, well, that'll just be incorporated into the amendment. So on 1.4, on the A169-1 amendment, it should be page 71 instead of page 70. Thank you for that catch. Any other discussion? If not, we will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and we will adopt those five parts of Article 3. On Article 5, on the sheet that you have, I would like at this time if we would remove the last two, definitions and standards for restrictive procedures, if we would eliminate that from the motion. And we'll come back to that at another time, if that would be okay. Otherwise, I'm ready to entertain a motion for the rest of Article 5. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I'd like
just
to move.
Senator Dahl, just hold on just one second. Someone have a cell phone that is on or working? Or that's usually what causes this mayhem. All right. All right, thank you.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I'd like to, in Article 5, move Senate language 978 3, Section 1. I'd also like to move in Article 5 from Senate File 978, 3, Section 4. I'd like to move from the Senate File 978, 3, Section 5. I'd like to move also in Article 5 from 978, Section 3, Section 6. In Article 5, I'd like to move House Section 9. I'd like to move also 978, 3, Section 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. In Article 5, part of my motion will include House Section 27 and 26. And finally, in this motion, moving Senate File 978, 3, Section 16.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Any discussion on those? If not, I'm going to call for the vote on the Dahl motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does prevail, and that part of Article 5 is adopted. I think we have one more article to look at, Article number 7.
Would you like me to move that, Mr. Chair?
That would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Article 7, I move Senate Section 4. In Article 7, Senate 9783, Sections 1 to 13. In Article 7, Senate 9783, Section 14.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? If not, Senator Torres Ray has made the motion on Article 7, those three provisions. I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail, and those parts are adopted. Well, members, I think a good first day's work. Senator Wieger has said again or wanted us to say that the meeting will be at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning right here. And he had mentioned the agenda early on. Be all day. Well, sounds like we get going, then we need to break after about an hour. I know the Senate has some things in the House. We meet at 10 tomorrow, I believe. So what we will, it's all-day kindergarten, early learning scholarship, and testing. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if we'll get much further than that. I know the integration achievement aid is there too. But so I think, and also open to testifiers, if folks want to testify tomorrow. Senator Torres Ray, anything you want to add before we adjourn?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's the schedule for tomorrow. We'll start at 8 and make some progress. The Senate will convene for a picture of the Senate at 9. And I we'll be gone for a half an hour. I don't know if we will, it will be, we'll probably have to caucus, so maybe we will break until after session.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman? Sure.
Yes. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. I just have a little announcement as I was coming here. My wife told me that apparently there's some a bill or amendment or whatever on coaching in this, and Channel 11 is doing a spot on it today. So
very good.
Channel 11, Channel 11 at 10 o'clock is doing a story on the somebody's coaching bill.
You will, Senate members, you'll realize Representative Erdahl is unrelenting as he pushes his proposals through. Anything else for the good of the order? Anything, Representative Reinert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if you have a sense, besides the morning, about, so we'll reconvene after the House adjourns? Is that the...
Well, that, I think, would be the intention right now, but we'll have to... We don't know anything for sure that well, other than we'll meet at 8 o'clock. Well, we have the legacy bill tomorrow. So
we could go all night.
We could, yeah. So at any rate, we will meet in the morning at 8, and looks like recess around 9 o'clock, and after that, we just don't know yet at this time.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. My only reason for asking is because we're taking testimony. Those who might try to make themselves available for testimony might benefit by as much clarity as we can give, and I know that's often not very much.
that's a good point. So we'll try our best probably to try to accommodate. He's here tomorrow. So anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that,
Senator?
I think it's important that if people in the audience would like to provide some information to the committee, that they could also send us a letter or some written testimony, because we do have, you know, both the House and the Senate are in session, and we go for hours, and we need to complete this work as well. So if people in the audience would like to provide some information to the committee, I think it's important that they send us a letter. A written testimony is always welcome, too.
Senator, that's a great point. Thank you for bringing that up. Seeing nothing, we are adjourned. Thank you.